So should we call this pilot? we call this the pilot, and then you can...
I'm going to call it episode one.
Episode one, all right, fine.
Yeah, let's go to episode one, because we've done a few of these now.
Yeah.
It's not my first rodeo.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah, go for it.
Here we go.
Let's go.
It feels weird without a clapper, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I can't start without...
So listen, welcome to episode one of the new podcast, coming to you straight out of Whitechapel, aka Le Chapel Blanc. So Pete and I are the hosts of the award-winning Author Hub C1D1 podcast, in which we chat with experts and orthopedic icons, many of them are household names from around the world.
Did we actually win any awards?
We've won loads of awards. Thank you, Bota. And we are about to become the host of the new Health Space podcast, where we delve into the world of health and wellness. So stay tuned. Say nothing. But in our day jobs, we're not, in fact, hard-hitting investigative journalists. What are we, Pete?
We're orthopaedic surgeons.
We are jobbing orthopods. We're trauma and orthopaedic surgeons at the Royal London Hospital, Barts. In fact, just yesterday, it was the 900th anniversary of St. Bartholomew's Hospital.
It was.
Were you there?
Rahir. Yeah, 900 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rahir was a monk.
He was a monk.
I thought he was a court jester or...
No. He was a monk. But okay. but he had a... Through a friend, he had a direct line into the royal ear, and right. So he was able to protect his hospital, which was where Barts is now. He was able to protect that site when all of the monasteries were being cleared out. His monastery, which had a hospital attached to it, was preserved because he had like the ear of the royals through some connections.
Henry VIII?
And to Henry VIII, exactly. Right. So Henry VIII was clearing out monasteries, but he kind of left that one because the hospital was basically looking after poor people. And they knew that if they wiped that out as well and they got rid of the monks, then the hospital would go and then that would be very unpopular because it was looking after the poor of central London.
Okay. Well, welcome to the New History of London podcast. thanks, Jeeves. Did you go to the 900th anniversary?
We did, yeah, at the Guild Hall. Yeah, it was awesome.
There was no ceremony at St. Paul's yesterday.
There was, the view day at Barts, which was, there was a service at St. Paul's, and it went on. And I met them all later on, and they were all hopelessly drunk by 8 in the evening. They were all like, you know, could hardly walk straight.
They must have lost my invite in the post. I think I had more chance of going to the coronation. So Pete and I, we're the course directors for a distance, i.e. all online masters in orthopaedic trauma science at Queen Mary University, London, also known as QMUL. Doesn't really flow, does it? Kuml?
Yeah, it does. It's not, does, Quimel? It doesn't flow off the tongue at all.
But you know what does flow?
What's that?
Boast. Like in the Boast guidelines.
Yes, Boast guidelines.
Do you see what I did there, Pete?
You know, it's a wonderful segue.
I'm really in the wrong job. I should be on the radio, like weeknights, midnight to four. Hospital radio. Literally the graveyard shift. So anywho, in the Author Hub C1D1 podcast, we're talking about the lives, practices, mantras and beliefs of the superstars of surgery. Fun, lighthearted conversations with a fair bit of joshing around. Joshing was not the word I'd written at first. But don't let that fool you, no. Oh no, we are serious people and we're here today in front of you, ready to make a global impact as humble educators of humanity. So no guests getting in the way, no nonsense, just some pure unadulterated Pete and Cash magic. So this new podcast, what's the plan, Pete?
So the plan is, this is about pushing our trauma, orthopaedic trauma MSc.
No, it's not.
Oh, is it not?
No.
Oh.
Well, it is, but we can't say that out loud. I'm here to sell you some drugs, Mr. Officer. what's the content going to be?
Okay.
Talk of that.
Okay.
I'll edit that bit out, don't worry.
So the plan today is to talk about open fractures. You mentioned Boast earlier on.
Yeah.
And
But we'll come back to that. We're going to talk about Boast. I want to know what the plan is for the podcast.
Okay. Crikey. You're asking mercurial questions here.
Does it sound mercurial? Is that one of those, number am I thinking
exactly,
of?
Exactly. Yeah, there's a bit of that going on.
So listen, that's apologies. And I thought I was dealing with a professional. It's going to be purely clinical, what I was going to say. And we're here to help and explain, make the day job easier, hopefully exams, and make people's lives better.
Yep.
So that's what we're about.
Agreed.
Is that okay? So if you like this and you want more of this and you want to come and study with us, no matter where or when in the world you are, then everyone's a winner. So Pete, what should we call this new podcast?
I think we should call this Pushing the Orthopaedic Trauma Sciences MSc.
Have you got anything catchy?
Why are we not allowed to say, you know, this is really an introduction to our Orthopaedic Trauma Sciences MSc?
That's a nice thing to say. You can say that.
Right.
I like that.
Okay.
But perhaps, have you got a better name than that, than pushing the orthopedic trauma science to the MSc?
Okay,
fine. What should we call it?
Let's call it, give me a suggestion.
Orthomasters.
Orthomasters.
I've already registered the name, so we're kind of stuck.
Okay, so this is the sequence of podcasts talking about, today we're doing open fractures, next one will be, what the f*** is the next one?
Pelvis.
Next one is pelvis.
Literally, then all you do. How do you forget that?
Next one is pelvis. Then we're doing bone healing. And we'll be working through a sequence of these over time as little sweeteners, little kind of introductions to orthopedic trauma to get people interested and hopefully raise enthusiasm to come and study us with the masters.
Yeah, a little free view. And I think if some of you know what I'm talking about. I'll put some links to it below, and you can find us on Twitter at Orthomasters. So we're going to kick off with talking about BOST guidelines. Pete, what is BOST? What does it stand for? Because there are guidelines everywhere, and we can't really keep up.
Absolutely, every country has its own orthopedic guidelines, elective surgery, and for trauma. In the UK, BOST guidelines, BOA, British Orthopaedic Association, ST, Standards for Trauma, BOST. There's a whole litany of them. There's almost 20 of them now, and each one covers a small, very focused area of orthopedic trauma. So you've got them on open fractures, you've got them on pelvic injuries, you've got them on ankle injuries, hip fractures, management of the elbow, and some of them are about specific injuries, some of them about specific contexts, like how to organise your rehabilitation, how to clear the spine in trauma. So there's a whole group of them.
Who comes up with them?
A panel of experts. So a panel of experts will choose a topic is chosen, a panel of suitable experts are pulled together, and they go away, study the literature, come back, discuss it, and pull it all together and try and make any guidelines that you're putting down, A, 100% evidence-based, mm-hmm. and B, practically useful. So actually it's helpful to clinicians and helpful to hospital managers.
One thing I would say is that there definitely is a practical element to reading these. You can tell these are written by people who've done the day job.
Absolutely.
Have you been on any of these expert panels?
I haven't, but because I've
neither have I. So how can they claim they're expert panels? the gall of them.
But people volunteer for these things. But you do also get invited if you're...
Oh, okay.
So there's a degree of both.
NFI.
Yeah. So what is good about
ghosts? What's good about ghosts? Nothing.
What is good about guidelines? Well, I mean, every country's got them. So New Zealand's got them, Australia's got them, America's got them. They're...
Are you going to name every country in the world?
Every country, or every developed country has guidelines of some sort. Why don't we just all use the same one? Because every healthcare system is slightly different. Mm-hmm. So they don't, ours would not apply in the US. We have a socialized NHS over there. It's more private based. And so the two don't marry each other up. And so it wouldn't work. But what is the point of guidelines? Well, the people, your immediate answer to that would be they give a standard of care. They say this should be your standard of care. You're sort of like, this is where your care should be.
A target to aim for.
Well, is it a target to aim for, or is it the floor of your care, like the minimum standard? And that's what it is not. And I think sometimes people think guidelines is you have to hit them 100% of the time in order not to be negligent.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely not what a guideline is. Guidelines are almost aspirational. Like if every person, it is impossible to hit 100% all of the time. You're never going to do that because... In trauma, in medicine in general, patients have other problems, don't they? Which intercede. People get chest infections. People, they have other issues, other problems. You have systemic issues within your hospital, which prevents you from doing the absolute A-star level of care. Nonetheless, if you know what that A-star level is, you can arrange your service to try and hit that. And you can audit your performance against it. So number one, it's something to audit against. And number two, and most importantly, particularly in our health system, is it's a vehicle for change.
It's a lever, isn't it?
It's a lever, exactly. So if we're supposed to be having a plastic surgeon every single operation of an open fracture, if that's the goal we're setting and we're not able to achieve that, I can go to our managers and I can say, look, this is the standard. We're not hitting it because we need more plastic surgeons. They are mandated to then go out and recruit and try and fill that void. So it's a lever for change.
I was about to make a really inappropriate gag about plastic surgeons, but I think I'll leave it. Everyone's got it. Everyone is in their head. I don't need to say it. As you say, it standardized it across the country. Everyone's doing the same thing. So the nice thing for the trainees, for the registrars rotating through the hospitals or anywhere in the country, everyone should be having the same standard. So it doesn't matter if you're working in Whitechapel or you're working in Inverness. The fact is, this is what you should be doing with an open fracture.
Exactly right. So everyone's playing to the same hymn sheet. You don't have one person following this guideline, another following a different one. It takes away that institutional variability. Mr. So-and-so likes doing this, whereas Miss So-and-so likes leaving them open or giving antibiotics for a bit longer. Everyone's doing something slightly different because it's all personality driven.
One of my favorite things, actually, just thinking back, was after fasciotomies, you know, when you do the, I love the bootlace technique.
Yes.
You don't see that anymore, do you?
Not anymore, no.
No. I've spent many a time yanking on a bootlace in my time taking.
Well, you don't see it in the UK anymore, no, because we have plastic surgeons at everything, the vast majority of surgeries, and so bootlaces aren't really a thing in their hands
because they're not clinically capable of you doing them.
I'm not sure that's it. I think they've got other tools.
Give me a bit of plastic and some clips. I'll soon close.
I think they have sharper tools in their armamentarium. Yeah. But if you don't have a plastic surgeon immediately available, actually bootlaces still do work. They're a way of orthopedic surgeons achieving a partial or complete closure of a wound without having to resort to split skin grafts or other techniques.
Although we're jumping ahead of us slightly, because the fact is, these open fractures, as we're about to find out, should be managed in a major trauma centre with an orthoplastic team.
Right. And so the British guidelines, as they stand, the BOST guidelines for open fractures, the emphasis here, if you could put it in one word, it is, as you say, orthoplastics. It is orthopaedic and plastic surgeons working in unison at all stages of the open fracture journey, if you like.
And the nice thing is the plastic surgeons can't deny that responsibility, because BAPRAS were involved, the British Association of Plastic Reconstructive and Aesthetic Surgeons,
yeah,
previously known as BAPS.
Yes,
that was their name. Well, you
yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
that for
yeah, yeah, no, yeah.
They they're involved in writing these, so they have ownership.
They have ownership. So yeah. the plastic surgeons are completely bought into this as a group. Absolutely. But orthoplastics is more than just orthopedic and plastic surgeons working together in a particular surgery. It's joint decision making. That's really the key. When a patient comes in, when you take them for that first debridement operation, you've got your orthopedic and plastic surgeon there, not necessarily to do anything more glamorous than debride the wound and put on an X-fix. What's going on there is the plastic surgeons say, right, okay, I've mapped out the perforators, I can see what the skin looks like, I know what my reconstruction is going to look like, and today is Monday, so I'm going to go and do an ALT flap on Wednesday, and orthopedics, so they're going to come in and they're going to put the tibial nail down, or they're going to put a plate on the feet on the tibia, or whatever it is that they're going to do. But it's more than that. It's more than just two people doing an operation together. You're doing joint clinics. You're doing joint rounds. You're auditing your performance together as an orthoplastic service, rather than it being a plastic surgery department and an orthopedic department. And they're kind of like, and if anything goes wrong, there can be in that setting a little bit of blame being thrown across the middle. Whereas if you're working as a unit, then it's totally different. And you're able to be a bit more dispassionate. Basically, you know, we're working as a team here. And if there's a failure going on, or like, you know, we're not hitting the target we should be, you can look at your working practice as a group.
So for orthoplastics, do you need a particular flavor of a plastic surgeon?
You totally do. Absolutely. You need a trauma junkie plastic surgeon. And these are people who've got micro fellowships, so they've got to be able to do anastomoses very, very easily, skills with a microscope, and they have got to be into trauma. They've got to love that whole thing of, like, you know, covering massive defects, working in suboptimal environments.
You're talking about Nottingham here. Hello, Ben.
you're working in suboptimal environments. So not only have you got like an open fracture here, but all the vessels, particularly the veins, are damaged in the surrounding area. So in order to plumb in your free flap, you've got to go some distance to find that. Often these patients are elderly. Their tissues aren't great. Even if you hadn't injured them, it would be difficult to plumb in. But now you've got an elderly patient. So there's a lot of there's a lot of technical difficulty, but also a lot of decision-making expertise that goes on, which isn't necessarily intuitive. You know, experience is a huge part of that role. So, yeah, you've got to have plastic surgeons who are into it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you say they've got to have a huge amount of experience, and yet the trauma junkies tend to be towards the beginning of their careers.
No, that's true. That's true. And so
it's not an old man's game by the looks of it.
I would agree with that. Although some of the real big hitters in the UK, like Umraz Khan in Bristol, you know, he's definitely, you would call him a mature surgeon now. He has been influential in the field for 15, 20 years plus as being a leading plastic surgeon, advocating this aggressive, you know, plastic surgeons being involved in every little bit of the treatment of the open fracture.
I worked with him actually back in the day at Charing Cross Hospital before he moved over.
Right, okay.
Before he went to the dark side. Is there any actual evidence that orthoplastic care works?
That's a great question. So Bristol, where Umraz Khan works, is have published their results. This was back in 2019, I think. That was back in 2019. They published in the BJJ.
Was that the Al-Harani paper?
It was the Al-Harani paper. And this particular article was then swept up in a whole load of controversy because part of the thrust of the paper was that they were putting back cortical fragments. The traditional treatment of open fractures is that any cortical fragments which fall out, you throw in the bin. But they were actually washing them, preserving them, and lagging them back in again as part of their reconstruction.
And that's what people would normally consider devitalized.
Exactly. Completely without blood supply, and yet they were preserving them, which kind of went against the traditional model. And so there's been a lot of back and forth about that. But if we just ignore the retaining cortical fragments piece of this paper, and you just look at their results, they've got they were only reporting on 3B open fractures. They had a decent number, 113, and deep infection rates of around 7%, which is using this orthoplastic approach. So forget the cortical fragments piece.
That's all I can think about now. You planted it in my head.
But they were reporting incredible results for proper open. These aren't just like little puncture wounds. These are the real deal, 3B open ones.
And the people listening, what's a 3B?
A 3B. Okay, so
tell us about that, Costello Anderson.
So a 1 is a puncture wound, and it's generally low energy. For grade 1s, your infection rates are almost exactly the same, are inseparable from closed injuries in terms of after they've been fixed and all the rest of it. So grade 1s don't really carry an increased infection rates. Grade 2 is that middle ground where you have a slightly bigger wound, slightly higher energy, but it's not been periosteally stripped, and it's definitely not contaminated. The grade 3s are the high energy injuries. And a 3A, essentially, you are able to get a primary closure. That's what defines it. A 3B is you can't get a primary closure, and therefore you have to resort to some kind of reconstruction. That is a skin graft, a local muscle flap, a local rotational flap, or a free flap, or some kind of transposition, or whatever it is. And then a 3C is an open fracture that also has a vascular injury requiring repair. And that's how I think of the three. A, you can close primarily. B, it requires some kind of plastics reconstruction. C, it requires some vascular reconstruction.
How comes I only get grade 4s when I'm on call?
And so, but the thrust of the BOS guidelines is that even for a grade 1, even for a grade 2, and certainly for a grade 3, the plastic surgeon needs to be there in order to help decide whether this is something that requires a reconstruction or not. If it's just an orthopod managing that debridement, that first debridement, there is an inclination on their part to try to close the wound, to get it closed.
Yeah.
And
Give me the Tychron.
If you know it's going to be at least a week and a half before you can interest a plastic surgeon to come and put some kind of a free flap on it, you will try and avoid that.
Yeah.
And so you will do something to try and avoid that. And that will sometimes work, but it won't work as often as a free flap will work. And therefore, over a large series, you will have a higher infection rate.
Understood. Now, one thing I want to know is this: the Bristol experience, this paper, Al-Harani paper.
Yeah.
How does their infection rate compare to the Wolf trial, the Sprint trial, you know, these other big papers?
And that's great. So when you look at other open fracture studies, there's a huge range of infection rates. None of them are better than 7.1% reported by Al-Harani. The thing that really sells for me the orthoplastic approach is not the Al-Harani paper, it's the Wolf trial, which was just looking at VAX. It was looking at use of VAX in open fractures.
And vacuum dressings.
Vacuum dressings, negative pressure wound therapy for open fractures. Let's just ignore the VAC business, because actually they showed no difference. They showed no evidence for negative pressure for open fractures. But if you just take the Wolf trial, which is basically looking at a whole bunch of open fractures in the UK, their infection rates were similar, 7 to 8%. So actually, it's not just Bristol doing it well. It's the whole, because we're all living by the same rules and we're all trying to do the same thing. Actually, the UK's open fractures, now this is across all grades, to be fair. So it's not just 3Bs like the Bristol guys were, but nonetheless, our open fracture rates, infection rates are incredibly low as a nation, which basically is, when you compare them to other series from other places around the world, none of them are as good as that.
Was Mike Kelly involved in this paper?
Mike Kelly was involved in the Al-Harani.
I'm not giving them any credit then.
No, but the Wolf trial is Matt Costa.
Yeah. So one thing, so essentially the lowest infection rate of all of them was in the Bristol group.
Correct.
So my takeaway is put back in the devitalized fragments for a lower infection risk. Thanks very much, folks. Well, okay, see you next week.
That. Yeah.
That's going to cause carnage.
Well, that is definitely the take home from the Bristol guys, but they absolutely stress the point that if you're going to do that, you have to have a plastic surgeon who's going to lay a flap on it at the same time that you retain it. And that's a really key element.
So you can't put
element
it back in and vac it.
You can put it back in, lag it, and then vac it, yes. But then when the vac comes off for the definitive closure, you almost have to take the whole thing down re-lag it, re-wash it, then put it back in, and then you'll do your definitive.
Just out of interest, forget the evidence, right? You are the trauma guru in the UK. That's what you told me to write. Is that what you've written here?
I so did not write that.
I'm reading your... No, I'm joking. But what's your take on that, out of interest? I've gone off piece now. I'm talking about devitalized fragments, putting them back in.
No, that's fine. I think that it works. I think
do you do it?
No, I don't. I don't do it.
You did.
I don't do it. No, I'm not sure how often it's incredibly helpful. Actually, I think one tends to do that in the setting where you don't have a limb reconstruction service who quite like. Restoring leg length with bone transport and you are familiar with frames. So I think sometimes clinical treatments are born out of adversity.
Necessity.
If you haven't got a service within your structure, you tend to find ways around it. And I think that's what Bristol did, because they didn't really have a big, well-developed frame service at their center. So they did this thing as a way of getting around. They had the frame service was down the road at their sister hospital.
I guess we'd be more inclined to do it if it's a huge defect, a critical piece of bone.
Yes.
And that, folks, is the end of part one of episode one of our new Ortho Masters podcast. Join us next week for part two, where we conclude the topic.